I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And here's what change looks like in Washington today. Republicans are calling for more tax cuts. Democrats want to pump money into infrastructure projects. Right now, the stimulus bill proposed by the Obama administration is two-thirds spending, one-third tax cuts, with some Republicans holding out for more cuts. But our first guest today says, how about a really radical change? How about collecting taxes rather than cutting them? And start by invading the Cayman Islands to shut down tax shelters. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston is only half serious about that invasion part, but very serious about recouping billions of dollars in taxes that he says should be paid. In his 40-year career, his reporting has led to closing so many loopholes, he's been called the tax enforcer-in-chief. And David offers his advice to the new president in this month's Mother Jones, so we want to spend a few minutes today hearing what he had to say. David joins us from WXXI in Rochester, New York. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, the invading thing? You're really not for that.
No, this is more along the lines of Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal that the Irish should eat their babies. But there is a serious issue here. America has two income tax systems, separate and unequal. One is for wage earners. The government knows exactly how much you make, and it has the taxes taken out of your paycheck before you get it. The government even knows how much your mortgage interest is and your interest on any savings account. But if you are a multinational corporation or a multinational business person, a large investor, you have all sorts of opportunities to hide money offshore. The government does not, in many cases, make any effort to collect or verify information on your income unless you get selected for audit. The Cayman Islands will tell you that, well, you know, we help the United States government catch tax cheats. Yes, if the U.S. government goes to the Cayman Islands and says, we've identified this person, here's who they are, we know they have records in your country, we want them, then they turn them over. Come on, that's not the system that wage earners are in, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars offshore. The Cayman Islands, this little spit, is the fifth biggest banking center in the world, and it's all in one building. There's no money in the building. It's all on paper.
Well, and you say if there's some strong arming with the Cayman Islands, it might also wake up Bermuda, go on to Switzerland, Luxembourg. This happens around the world. Tell us more about this, because you were saying two different systems, those of us who pay our taxes regularly, and the rich who can not only squirrel things away in tax havens, they can push their tax paying down the road.
That's exactly right. You and I are allowed to save, if we work for an employer with a 401k plan, $16,000, or if you're my age, another $6,000 for your retirement. If you don't have an employer with such a plan, you can only save $5,000 or $6,000 a year. But there's a little known provision in the tax code that if you are an athlete, a movie star, a business executive, a businessman, you may put aside unlimited amounts of money. Way back in 1996, I wrote a story about how the chief executive of the Coca-Cola company had built a billion-dollar untaxed fortune this way.
We don't understand this. You know, how do you get to $1 billion without paying taxes?
You get a paycheck. Whether you cash it or not, you have to pay taxes on that money. But executives and others are allowed to loan money to their companies to defer it before they pay their taxes. And so let's say you're an executive, you get $105 million this year.
Yeah.
You want $5 million to live on after tax. That'll leave you $3 million roughly. And then you say to the company, keep the $100 million and I want you to guarantee me 7% interest or the value of our stock if it's higher. And the company does not get to deduct that. So they, in essence, pay the taxes on your behalf. And the money grows and grows and grows. And when you get to retirement, you can then take the money. But there's another trick you can do. You can have this money used to buy a life insurance policy in a trust that will pay out at your death to your heirs. And then the company gets to deduct the expense and you never have to pay taxes on it.
And what about the estate tax?
The estate tax does not apply if you put your life insurance in a trust. And, Robin, this is just one of myriad vehicles that I've exposed over the years about how unfair the tax system is.
How much do you think the U.S. government, David, loses in tax income every year from the 1% of Americans who are super rich who aren't paying their taxes?
The government's own estimate is that the tax gap, as they call it, is about $1 billion a day, about $360 billion a year. Now, that's the official government estimate. Nobody I know who's seriously involved in these issues thinks that that number is near reality at all.
No, you're kidding.
No. And little fact for you here. When I reported this, the Bush administration acknowledged the accuracy, or they called reasonable, the numbers I'm going to give you. If you make $50,000 to $75,000, you pay a larger share of your income to the federal government each year than people who make $100 million a year. You pay the same share. If you make $100,000 to $200,000, you pay a larger share. If you make $500,000, now that'll put you in almost the top half of 1% of Americans. It's well inside the top 1%. If you make $500,000 a year, the share of your income you will pay to the federal government is significantly higher than people who make $1 billion annual income.
Well, it's just incredible. And as we said, you lay it out in Mother Jones and also your ideas for how some of, you know, this gap can be reduced. Talk about companies like Walmart that take advantage of something called the sales tax give back.
All across America, big box retailers, Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, and in some cases entire shopping centers, are being built with your tax dollars. You walk into these places, and you don't know this, but legally, those stores and shopping malls get to keep the sales taxes that you pay at the counter, and they use them to pay the costs of acquiring the land and building the store. And while these deals are in place, technically, the store building is owned by a nonprofit agency that's a government corporation, so it doesn't pay sales taxes in many cases either. What does that mean? Well, first of all, it means the police and the fire department and the schools, they're not getting the tax dollars. Secondly, it means that those employers who don't get this deal, like locally owned merchants, they're being driven out of business. Now, the advocates will tell you that these deals create jobs. That's the reason for doing it. In the community where I live, there's a proposal for the most high-end mall here to get $60 million of taxpayer money so that we can have some more high-end department stores here. You only create retail jobs when either people have more money to spend because their incomes are rising or the population grows. Where I live here, incomes are down 10% adjusted for inflation compared to a decade ago, and the population is the same. What that means then is that when you create a job at these subsidized stores, you are destroying jobs at other businesses, and they tend to be locally owned retail establishments.
Plus, we've had Michael Schumann on the program, who's written so much about this in his book, Small Mart. These companies tend to move on.
They often do. In fact, there's a Lowe's in West Virginia, which when its deal ran out at the end of 7 years, the store was paid for and they would no longer be able to keep the sales taxes. They built a new store right nearby, and in the middle of the night, trucks came and they just moved everything to the new location so they could continue to operate tax-free.
Do not tell me this. I'm sorry, but it's just, this sounds, you know, I'm sure people have said to you, that's incredible. That can't be. That's got to be against the law.
Every state constitution that I have read prohibits gifts to corporations. So how do you get around this? Well, they enact laws or policies that are the same as what Louisiana did when it allowed gambling. The Louisiana Constitution bans gambling, so they just redefined gambling to not mean anything you and I think of as gambling, so that things like slot machines and poker and whatnot didn't fit the definition of the law.
And so that could be allowed. Well, staying along the same lines of corporations keeping taxes, you write that public utilities collect taxes but then hold on to them. For example, Oregon's Portland General Electric collected $900 million in taxes over 10 years, but then paid less than $1 million to the state.
Well, this is going on all over the country that utilities are doing this. Utilities are essentially monopolies, legal monopolies. So all the money that they need to operate has to come from you, the customer, when you buy electricity, water, whatever the utility service is. That includes the taxes they have to pay on their profits. Well, the law assumes that the utility pays taxes and files its own tax return. But in fact, most utilities are owned by a corporate parent. So the corporate parent then goes and has other operations which may have lost money, or it buys tax losses from someone else, or it engages in tax sheltering behavior, and the corporate parent pays little or no taxes. So in essence, the taxes that you paid that are embedded in your electric bill are turned over to the parent company. They never get to the government, and that means you have to pay twice. You have to, first of all, you paid the tax on behalf of the company and the rate, And then you have to pay it again by either paying more taxes, by having more government borrowing that crowds out of the spending, or by giving up government services.
So what can the federal government do to change this, to make sure that utility companies pay the taxes they collect from taxpayers?
Well, Congress can simply pass a law that says that you have to turn these taxes over. There is an existing law that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has not done anything about. There is a principle in utility law that because these are monopolies, they are only entitled to earn what are called just and reasonable rates of return. That's why you regulate them, so they can't charge unreasonable prices. Well, if they get to pocket the taxes, that means they're earning a higher profit margin than the regulators have set. And the Bush administration was totally, completely against any effort in the direction of requiring that these taxes be paid or be returned to the customers. It'll be interesting to see if the Obama administration ignores this issue or does something to correct it.
Well, some of the other ideas you outline include protecting pensions, making sure that companies can't dip into them, you know, use their workers' savings and deplete them if a company fails. You say that big CEOs, corporate America, should be asked to pay full taxes for the cost, something like $100,000 of using their private jets. You ask to end the burglar alarm subsidy. We didn't understand this. You say each time police respond to a burglar alarm, it costs taxpayers $50 or more, a total of $1.8 billion. But half of that goes to Tyco, which owns ADT Security. How so?
If you listen to the ads on television, they've just changed them as a result of my book, Free Lunch, and revealing what they're doing. The ads on TV will show a dark and stormy night and a housewife who, of course, is Hollywood beautiful with children around her cowering and a flash of lightning, and there's some guy at the front window with a Bowie knife between his teeth looking menacing. Right?
Yeah, he's scared.
And all of a sudden, an alarm goes off and the lights come up and the announcer says, "But your family's safe and the police are on their way because you bought a burglar alarm." Well, that's the subsidy. The police are on their way. All the burglar alarm company does is install a little electronic device on your phone line that if the burglar alarm is tripped, calls a computer. They telephone you, and if they don't get the right answers, they telephone the police. The expense is sending a cop car. ADT has 40% of the market, and it is getting effectively $800 million a year of free labor provided by local police departments.
So what you're saying is these alarm companies that are, you know, reaping the benefits of selling these alarm systems should be paying for security services to go respond to the alarms.
The logical way to handle this is that if you want a burglar alarm, you pay to have a response by a private organization, or the taxpayers get to bill you for the cost of that response.
Instead of taxpayers paying for the cops. Well, you say that Washington, by the way, should threaten to cut federal funding to any community that fails to charge alarm companies the cost of their responses. Just some ideas from David K. Johnston, formerly the tax reporter for the New York Times. You may be nodding and agreeing, but wait till you hear what he says about your mortgage deductions. He doesn't think you should have them. We'll have more with David in a minute here and now. Welcome back. In a few minutes, former evangelical leader Ted Haggard's new accuser is actually an old story in Haggard's former church. But first, we want to wrap up our conversation with journalist David K. Johnston. He says the tax system has to be tightened, closing loopholes that benefit only the very wealthy and corporations. And David, you say corporations live by a different set of rules than the rest of us because they can actually use past losses to reduce their current tax bills?
You know, you have to pay taxes, Robin, on your earnings this year. Well, what if you made a lot of money this year and the next year you don't make any money at all? You can't go back and get your taxes back. Companies are allowed to do that. They're allowed to reach back. And so when they have a profitable year, they go back to the years where they had losses and paid no taxes, and they get to use those losses to offset their profits. They're doing what Congress requires. Why does Congress require this? Well, that's what campaign contributions and lobbying are about.
Well, David, a lot of the ideas you're proposing might sound reasonable to the average person, you know, shutting down overseas tax havens, closing loopholes that only benefit the wealthy and corporations. But then we get to the part where you say get rid of the deduction for interest paid on mortgages, and that's going to affect a lot more people. Why would you do that?
You know, 70% of Americans own their own homes. but less than half of homeowners get any tax benefit. And that's because if you file the short form tax return, which 70% of Americans do, you don't get to deduct mortgage interest. You don't get to deduct property taxes. I argue that what we should do, if we're going to have a subsidy, and by the way, the Canadians have no such subsidy and they have the same home ownership rate we do. But if we want to have a subsidy, offer a one-time to new home buyers subsidy where for the first 10 years you own the house, the government will match how much you pay down your mortgage up to a total of $7,000 over 10 years. So if you get a $100,000 mortgage, you pay off $7,000, the government gives you $7,000. Now we've given you a subsidy that has helped you get out of debt and actually own your home.
David K. Johnston, again, just your ideas for closing loopholes, changing the tax system so that more taxes come from the very top of the economic ladder. Do you really have hope that there will be change?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the whole principle on which we founded this country was that we don't need King George to tell us what to do. We will solve any problem we want. We will control our own destiny. We can change this. People simply have to know the facts. Unfortunately, we have this national myth that the rich are heavily taxed and that the money is redistributed down. What I've shown is that, in fact, we have a massive redistribution program upward, that the highest income people in America pay very big dollars to the federal government, but as a share of their income, many of them pay less than middle class and upper middle class Americans do.
And largely because of these loopholes you'd like to close. David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His recent article in Mother Jones is called Fiscal Therapy. He's also author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense, and Stick You with the Bill. It's now out in paperback. David, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Robin.
A former church member is speaking out about a sexual relationship he had with former evangelical leader Ted Haggard before Haggard's 2006 fall from grace with male prostitute Mike Jones. 25-year-old Grant Haas says he was prompted to speak out now by what's being called a sympathetic HBO documentary about Haggard that premieres this week. Haas told his story to investigative reporter Tack Landrock of KRDO-TV in Colorado Springs last night. Now, parents, be warned, there's some explicit language coming because, Tack, Grant Haas told you he came to Haggard's church in 2005 struggling with homosexuality. Haggard immediately developed an intense bond, sending Haas up to 2,000 text messages a month. They went on a trip together. Haggard masturbated in front of Haas. The question this raises is, when did Haggard's New Life Mega Church in Colorado Springs know about Haas?
Well, you know, once Mike Jones, this is the gay escort that outed, if you want to say that, Ted Haggard, basically Grant sent a text message to one of the senior pastors at New Life Church here in Colorado Springs. And it took them 3 weeks to get back to Grant, but Grant wanted to tell them that, hey, this was not the first time Ted Haggard, you know, did something inappropriate.
And then, in fact, he began talks with the church, and apparently the church accepted his story because they offered to do what for Haas?
Well, they offered to pay his medical bills and to help him with counseling. Now, the interesting thing is that counseling, according to Grant, was just job counseling. It wasn't, you know, therapy or anything like that. It was a job counseling and, of course, pastoral care and stuff like that. But Grant was very frustrated with the church because the church kept on telling him they would pay for his medical bills, but they were never paid. And that's the reason Grant went and got a lawyer to, you know, threaten to sue the church.
So at this point, we're in around 2007. Grant Haas is threatening a lawsuit. He's also still talking to Ted Haggard. We have a little bit of a 2007 phone call that Haas recorded and told Haggard that he deleted all those text messages. Haggard seemed to be pleased and then tried to convince Haas to drop the lawsuit. Let's listen.
It's better to forgive and let it go.
Yeah.
Forgive the people that have wronged you. I've wronged you. Forgive me. If the church has wronged you, forgive it.
Well, forgiving is one thing, but did Haas drop the lawsuit?
Well, he eventually did because the church basically settled with him on a six-figure deal. That deal was about $180,000 over three payments over about a two-year time span. And, you know, Grant was not supposed to speak about this to anyone, but he felt it was very important to come out and talk about this with this new HBO documentary, because he's worried that Hagerty will get back into a position of power, maybe back into a ministry, and possibly re-abuse again.
By the way, HBO says the film by Alexandra Pelosi will air on Thursday unedited, but will have an on-screen graphic that acknowledges the new accusations against Ted Hagerty. Tack Landrock, is it your sense that there are going to be more stories coming forward about Ted Hagerty?
Well, you know, New Life Church has already admitted that there are other victims out there. Speaking to Grant, he has been told that there are as many as 10 others. New Life Church has never confirmed that number with us.
Well, Tack, Grant Haas did have, though, thousands of real text messages. How is the community responding to this latest wrinkle?
Well, I think, you know, it's a mix, because New Life Church is one of the biggest churches here in Colorado Springs, and a lot of the congregation is very upset with me for revealing this story. But, you know, I'm going to defend myself and say this is a story that needed to be told, and they needed to know that, you know, money was paid out to this young man to keep quiet.
Tack Landrock, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin.
And again, Tack is with KRDO-TV in Colorado Springs. Well, later today, the beautiful music of Beethoven, all of it, as you'll hear, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Palestinians set off a bomb early today, killing an Israeli soldier on the border with Gaza. Israeli troops responded with gunfire, killing a Palestinian farmer. A reminder of why the phrase ceasefire is always preceded by the word fragile in this region. It's been 10 days since Israel's assault, inspired by rockets from Gaza, ended. Aid troops are trying to rebuild. Special U.S. Envoy George Mitchell is in the region. And President Obama made the Middle East the subject of his first White House television interview, which he gave to the pro-West Dubai-based Arabia News. The president saying the moment is ripe for renewed peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. But is it? Tim McGurk is Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine. And Tim, we've reached you on a noisy cell phone, so we have apologies to our listeners. But it's because you just scooted back from Gaza to Jerusalem as the border closed today?
Yeah, the gates literally slammed shut just after we got across. Because of this one incident where the bomb went off on an Israeli patrol on the Israeli side of the border.
You report online today a chilling story of something you heard in Gaza. A Palestinian father, Khaled Abed Rabou, tells you of a day much earlier this month, before the ceasefire, when Israeli tanks pulled outside his home. Now, neighbors tell you that Israelis warned by loudspeakers that residents should evacuate. Rabou says he tried to shepherd his little girls and his wife and mother to the door. What did he tell you happened?
Well, he said that he went to the door obeying what he'd heard the Israelis say over the loudspeakers, and he was with his three very young daughters, his wife and his mother-in-law, and the little kids were waving white flags. And he claims that at that moment there were two Israeli soldiers beside the tank. They were relaxed. They were eating chocolate and a bag of potato chips. And then when they appeared at the door, then a third Israeli soldier popped out of the tank with his M16 rifle and opened fire on the kids, shooting and killing the two-year-old first, then shooting and wounding badly the four-year-old, and shooting and killing the seven-year-old and his mother-in-law before he was able to drag them inside.
He then tried to at least get the wounded to the hospital, he says, and neighbors, he says, tried to save him, a man with a donkey cart, a man with an ambulance, and residents tell you that the soldiers killed the would-be rescuers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, first they screamed out for an ambulance, and it just so happened that there was one close by, and we spoke to the ambulance driver, and he said he heard the screams and was about to come barreling over. But then the Israelis pulled him out of the ambulance, roughed him up, and then later destroyed his ambulance. So the family then were stuck pinned down there for 2 hours. And then finally, the grandfather said, look, I'm old. I'm willing to sacrifice myself to try to save the life of at least one of my children. And so he picked up the little wounded girl and walked to the door, walked outside. And this time the Israelis let him go by. So they trooped up the road, about 10 members of the family, and they claimed that as they were walking, the Israelis were shooting the dust around them. They loaded the wounded onto a donkey cart, and they claimed that the Israelis opened fire on the man with the donkey cart, killing the man and then killing the donkey. And they were forced to proceed on foot to the hospital, but it was too late.
How many children died?
Two of his three daughters died, and his mother-in-law.
And you were in the area. You saw the destroyed ambulance. Did you see the dead donkey?
I did see the dead donkey, yeah. They pulled it off to the side of the road and tried to bury it.
Well, it's a terrible, terrible story. The residents denied that Hamas was in the area, but one man pulled you aside and whispered otherwise.
That's right. It's kind of a tricky situation because Hamas are in control of the place, and they're in a foul mood right now. They're supposedly going around and shooting the kneecaps of people who they think collaborated with the Israelis, so it's hard to get anyone to speak that truthfully. The people in the neighborhood said, no, there were no Hamas rockets from being fired here. It's too exposed, so they didn't use this area. But this one middle-aged man drew me aside and said, look, this is nonsense. There were Hamas rockets from being fired from here. And he accused Hamas of quietly, to us only, of bringing the wrath of the Israeli army down on this neighborhood.
Well, you know, it seems that this horrible story, you know, stands as a metaphor for the conflict. Israel feels attacked by Hamas militants hiding among the civilians. But Israel can only be creating more militants and losing any goodwill by killing those civilians.
I think that's exactly true, Robin. And if Israel's intent was to go in and hammer them so that the people would rise up against Hamas, it hasn't happened. They see Israel as the enemy. They see Israel as the one that destroyed 4,000 houses, pretty much all of their factories. And they think of Hamas as the only people who dared to kind of poke a stick at this great big angry bear, which is how they see Israel.
Although, again, it was so interesting to read that there was a Gazan who pulled you aside who said, it's Hamas that has done this to us. And by the way, we should add the Israeli military has vowed to conduct an investigation of Khaled Abed Rabu's story. But in the meantime, you also went to the tunnels between Gaza and the Egyptian border, which Israel hoped to close down by bombing them. You met the diggers who are already rebuilding. What did they tell you?
People are busy digging away new tunnels, repairing the old tunnels, and saying, look, these tunnels are our only lifeline because the Israelis have kept Gaza under an economic blockade for the past 18 months. So how else are we going to get our diapers? How else are we going to get the food, the spare parts?
But did you hear any resentment from the Gazans that they're feverishly building these tunnels to bring food and fuel, and they know that Hamas has these huge other tunnels that are bringing in weapons?
You know, the resentment they feel is towards Israel, towards Egypt and the international community.
As we said, Special Envoy George Mitchell is on his way to the area. Barack Obama is now president. You had Israelis say to you that perhaps George W. Bush was a little too much of a friend to Israel, maybe didn't give them the guidance that they could have used. Do you see the situation changing with a new president?
The Israelis are much more cautious about Obama. Bush, for example, didn't stop them in their war in Lebanon. And Israelis, to me later on, said, why didn't the Americans stop us? You know, there we were getting in deeper and getting in worse trouble. We needed the Americans to come in and say, enough is enough, get out of Lebanon. And I think what they need and what they're looking for in Washington is a president who's going to be an honest broker, who realizes that there has to be compromises on the Palestinian side. They have to put down their weapons. They have to stop shelling innocent civilians in Sderot and other towns along the Gaza border. And there has to be compromise on the Israeli side. They have to start doing what they've vowed to do, which is remove some of the settlements from the West Bank.
That's Tim McGurk, a Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure.
And you're listening to Here and Now. In which states is it actually illegal to pump your own gas? Or what do you do when a deer leaps in front of your car? Pete DeMarco writes a weekly column in the Boston Globe called Who Taught You to Drive? And today we want to take his road smarts quiz, as we say it here. You can follow along on our website, here-now.org. Pete, let's start with, in which states is it actually illegal to pump your own gas? Multiple choice, A, New Jersey and Maryland, B, Oregon and New Jersey, C, Alaska and Hawaii, or D, Florida?
Any guesses, Robin?
Well, D, you give us a little help. You say in Florida, the law requires gas attendants to help seniors. So maybe that, maybe D, Florida.
D was actually the trick answer.
Ah.
The answer is B, Oregon and New Jersey. And the law goes back to the days when people weren't sure whether gasoline was safe. So they had attendants pump their gas. But the people in those states, they actually loved this law. In Oregon a few years ago, there was a state referendum to get rid of the you can't pump your own gas law. And it failed. And the reason is that people there really believe that they get better service at the same price as if they were doing self-serve. And sure enough, Oregon's average price of gas today is cheaper than Washington State and cheaper than California. And sure enough, in New Jersey, the average price of gas today is cheaper than New York and cheaper than Pennsylvania. And they're getting it served to them without having to get out of their car on a very cold day.
Well, that's so interesting. Okay, let's move on to the deer. A deer suddenly jumps in front of your moving car. What's the first thing you should do? The choice is hit the brakes, then swerve, blast the horn, swerve as fast as you can, shut off your headlights. They frighten the deer. I would swerve like crazy, C.
And that would probably be your gut reaction. What you should do, according to driving experts, is slam on the brakes first and then swerve. That way, you have more control when you actually turn the wheel.
Huh. Okay, I want to go on with these because they are fascinating. Now, you're driving on the highway, and all of a sudden, your gas pedal is stuck. The horror. What do you do? A, hit your emergency brake. B, turn off the ignition, let the car roll to a stop. C, put the car in neutral and apply the brakes. D, put the car in neutral and apply the emergency brake. My instinct would be just to hit the brakes, but you don't give that option. You say put the car in neutral and apply the brakes. So I'm going to have to go with that. But why is that?
By putting the car in neutral, you basically disengage the engine, so you automatically slow down the car. If you just hit the brakes as you're zooming at 60 miles an hour and the gas is still going, the engine's still cranking, they're going to be working against each other.
Well, that's why the correct answer on this one is actually twofold. You can either, as you say, put the car in neutral and apply the brakes, or B, turn off the ignition and let the car roll to a stop.
And the reason is there's some conflicting viewpoints. By putting the car in neutral and applying the brakes, there's a chance you could actually destroy your engine, but you come to a stop. By turning off the ignition, you won't destroy your engine, but it will probably take longer for you to come to a stop.
Okay, so if you have the room, turn off the ignition and let the car roll to a stop. Well, Pete, I want to move along to something found in Massachusetts, and we hear Canada, a flashing green light. Now, does it mean a crosswalk is near, or B, there's no such thing as a flashing green light, or C, the traffic signal is broken, D, stop and proceed with caution, or E, Animal Crossing ahead? Which is it?
Flashing green light is A, crosswalk is near. You might see these in the middle of a long block where there's not a three-light traffic light. It may just be a flashing green. I don't know why this light still exists. It's pretty arcane, but it's you find them here and there.
Okay, I want to go on with these because they are fascinating. Now, in number seven, this is so apropos right now. Can you get a ticket for having too much snow on your windshield? A, you can't get a ticket. B, it's only illegal where declared by local ordinances. C, it's a state law, it's a $10 fine. D, state law, $35 fine. I would say C, state law, $10 fine.
Close, but maybe you didn't factor in inflation. State law, $35 fine.
Well, you know, we checked around on this one, and, you know, whatever state you live in, you usually have to keep your windshield clear.
Right. It makes sense. In Massachusetts, you'd be charged with impeded operation. It's the same charge as if you were maybe putting lipstick on while driving and drinking your coffee. It's things you shouldn't be doing in a car, but we all do anyway.
Pete DeMarco, Boston Globe columnist. His column is Who Taught You How to Drive? Pete, thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, it was great being here. Thanks again.
And before we go today, a classical music milestone. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. Two new reports confirm what colleges and universities already suspected. The Common Fund Institute and TIAA-CREF report that public and private school endowments have fallen about 23% on average in the 5 months that ended November 30th. We know colleges are freezing wages, halting construction, and now Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts, has announced it will close its noted art museum and sell a collection possibly worth over $300 million. Brandeis President Yehuda Reinhartz joins us. And President Reinhartz, you know, this decision was reported today in the Boston Globe. A lot of people are pretty upset by this decision.
Well, I'm upset that we had to make this kind of a decision, but we had to weigh the choices. And for us, the first and most important function of the university is to deliver a first-rate education to support our students and faculty.
Well, you were quoted in the Globe as saying that the Rose Museum was a jewel, but a hidden jewel, because, first of all, few people actually went to see it, but also that the great works that the museum had, you weren't able to exhibit. Why?
Well, we simply don't have the space to exhibit the permanent collection on a regular basis. We have made valiant efforts in the past to build another wing for the Rose, but this was not successful.
Well, one board overseer, John Lee, says Brandeis has now become a second-class institution. And you have unhappy donors like David Genzer, who donated a drawing to the museum and who realizes now, you know, it might not stay in the museum. What do you say to these critics?
Well, first of all, I can understand their anger. This is a sad day for Brandeis and for all of us. Now, if you look at what other institutions are doing around the country, for the most part, they cut. They cut programs, they cut faculty, they cut departments, centers, institutes, and so on. We could do the same thing. The question is, why would anybody want to send students to Brandeis if, in fact, our core mission of instruction and research is weakened?
You're saying a painting rather than a professor.
Well, one of the faculty members has said it best. She said that she'd rather keep the artists than the art. We would have to lay off an incredible number of faculty in order to meet the long-term issues that are created by our environment. This is a problem that's going to be with us for a number of years. We don't know for how long, but it's certainly not short-term.
Brandeis University President Yehuda Reinhartz on the school's decision to close the Rose Arts Museum and auction off the collection. President Reinhartz, thank you and best to you.
Thank you very much.
The Hungarian pianist András Schiff enchants with his warm tone and commanding interpretations. Now in his prime, Schiff has reached a classical music milestone with his recording of the complete Beethoven sonata cycle. Our music critic Tim Riley says this latest chapter in Schiff's career will change the way you hear some of piano's most familiar music.
That's András Schiff performing the opening passage from Beethoven's Sonata Opus 109 in E major. It's from the final installment of his complete Beethoven cycle for the ECM label. There's a lot to celebrate here. For starters, there's Schiff's luxurious tone. His playing lulls you even into the most difficult music, and this late Beethoven material might be more intimidating to players than to listeners. Luckily, András Schiff shares his ideas about these challenging works in a series of podcasts he made for the Guardian newspaper in London. He talks about how performers struggle with Beethoven scores, which are both messy and enigmatic.
A lot of this music sounds improvisatory. Sounds like an improvisation, but don't believe what you hear, because it's very, very carefully thought out, and his instructions are incredibly detailed.
Late Beethoven has a reputation for lofty philosophy. But Schiff reminds us that engaging with the score and with the instrument remains central to figuring out Beethoven's deconstruction of sonata form.
It's very, very difficult to talk about Beethoven sonatas, but especially difficult to talk about the final three because they are just so great that words fail, at least my words.
Well, words may fail András Schiff, but he talks about Beethoven with such fluency, he'll make you feel smarter just hearing how he approaches these sonatas. Listen to how Schiff describes that ethereal, otherworldly opening to the E major sonata.
To me, the miracle of this movement is that it does not begin. It continues. It comes from somewhere. There is no distinct beginning, and it is really very, very poetic indeed. One doesn't feel any downbeats or any bar lines. It just floats.
The idea of starting a sonata somewhere in the middle, as a continuation of something much larger yet invisible, rings especially true of late Beethoven. After all, by the 1820s, the composer had lost almost all of his hearing. He finished some final string quartets, his vast Missa Solemnis, and these late piano works in near silence. At the same time, Beethoven was music's most notorious composer, a distempered loner who roamed Vienna like a sainted churl. The contrasts in late Beethoven swerve suddenly between celestial and earthbound. Here's how the movement lurches from its gently rolling opening theme to a stormy, tormented second melody. Schiff makes sense of these wildly opposing melodies by locating their common pulse and connecting them from beneath with their hidden similarities.
I think you feel that there is a relationship between these two tempi. One is lively, the other one is slow, but they share the same heartbeat. And this is how we have a sense of unity.
This Beethoven set stands with titans like Stephen Kovacevic or Richard Good, or even the friendly godfather of Beethoven cycles, Artur Schnabel. Like these others, Schiff's Beethoven stands as something far more than just another notch in a pianist's dance card. Can you ever reread Shakespeare too often? With his lean yet seductive lines, Schiff persuades even specialized listeners that no matter how much Beethoven you listen to, there's always more to hear.